We can finance SARS and humble them before us.
That's right. We should be kind of.
Yes.
People are today just hanging down every day.
It's a fun day. Usually we just have.
We sit around and talk about sex crimes.
That's right.
You've gotten out your version of the budget. Afford to be loose.
No, we're just waiting on the CS on our psychological equivalent of the budget.
Okay, let's go ahead and call the meeting to order. We're taking up House Bill 803 and act related to the adjudication of challenges to regulations of state agencies. And we have Representative Cooper here this morning. Mr. Cooper, did you want to copy this?
I kind of like him, Chairman. I think I know what the deal is. Basically, Mr. Chairman, I think every legislator gets a lot of complaints from the citizens about regulations and things like that. And right now, what you get to do if you don't like the regulation, you can call the legislature and maybe the administrative committee will move and maybe they won't. And certainly it would be a little difficult, for instance, to get the administrative review committee together during, say, an election season. It would be a little hard to get them to meet in October. I think that people ought to get a quick way to resolve the questions that are listed here, whether a regulation is constitutional, whether it's not in conformity with legislative intent, which is really the bulk of most of them, or it's unreasonable per se, or if it's unreasonable as applied to the petitioner, or if it hasn't been validly adopted. There ought to be a quick way to raise those questions. As things stand right now, what you have to do is exhaust all your administrative remedies, then you have to go to the court system, and by the time you get any action, it might be 4, 5, or 6 years, and you might find that that if you don't have $8,000 or $9,000 or $10,000 to pay a lawyer, you might as well just forget it. And what this piece of legislation seeks to do, in any event, is to provide a quick remedy to people who have a complaint about regulations within in this limited sense. I would think that if they just don't like the regulation, then they can go to the Administrative Review Committee. But these other questions, I think, are properly addressed by the courts, and they ought to be able to go immediately there. Frankly, an administrative council is no place. I'm not speaking of the committee, I'm speaking of the various routes of administrative appeal that people have to go to. That's no place to get a question on legislative intent decided, or the constitutionality of the statute, or the reasonableness of the regulation. You can't really get a decision there. And if you have those questions to be decided, you should be able to go directly to the court. And what I had in mind was the Chief Justice designating a judge to sit as a regulatory judge for whatever time is necessary in view of the number of complaints that are out. And it may be like 2 days a month in Anchorage, and 1 day a month in Fairbanks, and 1 day a month in Ketchikan and, you know, Bethel and so forth, depending on the volume. But that judge, when he's designated by the CJ, he's required to do this and nothing else. He doesn't get to say, well, I'll hear you in 1987 because I've got 4,000 criminal trials before I can get to you. He doesn't get to do that. He has to take these first. The guy who's got a complaint about a regulation comes in and pays his $100 to the clerk, and the clerk says, the clerk helps him fill out the forms. She sends him to some place, some central place that the Chief Justice can check on when he's designating these judges to sit. It would work kind of like the Workers' Comp Board does, because they travel around to various towns and that kind of thing. Although here, you wouldn't have to have a traveling judge. You could just use one in whatever place. Then when the guy comes in, the clerk can say, okay, what's your complaint? What's the regulation you have a problem with? And she helps him fill out the form. The form gets filed, and she says, okay, the administrative law judge is coming next month on, you know, April the 9th, and you'll get a notice of that hearing. And the guy comes in, and the judge treats it much in the way of a workman's comp hearing. He tries to get out, you know, as many facts, if any, as are necessary for him to make the finding. But under this bill, except where the question is raised as to the reasonableness of the regulation, it'll all be a question of law anyway. And the judge should be able to decide that easily within 30 days. Now, I think the cost of it, what we should do is to add an extra clerk and an extra law clerk to help decide these questions, and perhaps Art Snowden would have a better idea as to how best to administer it. But the point is to get these things decided in a hurry so that people don't have to spend years and years and thousands of dollars when they have a regulation that might well be completely out of whack with legislative intent.
Thank you. I strongly support the bill, but I call your attention to page 2, lines 13 and 14. I wonder if two things shouldn't be done there in order to, one, make clear the language, and two, to avoid vexatious challenges of regulations. To the first point, I would suggest that it read on line 15, for all regulations challenged at one time within a single title of the last administrative code, so that we know that the maximum is applied to what we're challenging at one time, rather than you can accumulate challenges within a single title up to the maximum. And I'd recommend that the maximum filing fee be raised from 100 to 200, and that the maximum, the not to exceed figure, should be $600. That would make it substantial enough to keep the vexatious part out. I know this is an arbitrary thing, but I have a hunch that a person would think twice about $200. We're rapidly approaching the time in Alaska we don't think all that much about $100.
Well, it depends, Mr.
Carter. I see a great opportunity here for cranks to really be vexatious at great cost to the, relatively speaking, to the taxpayer. I want them to have this low-cost remedy, and I think it's very necessary. I just would up the ante a tad, as they say.
Like double?
And, of course, if they get it back, it's a win.
I think it's completely, I'd like to confine the discussion just to question Mr. Cooper, because they have to get back up.
Well, my question is, what did you think of your suggestion?
That's fine. I certainly think that your original suggestion on the at-one-time language probably ought to go in there. And I think money is just a matter of policy. I think you might be right that it may be necessary to bring it up somewhere.
Mr. Miles?
This doesn't change the status of the administrative regulation review committee,
though, right? No, they can go there, too.
Yeah, they still have all the chink of theirs that they have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chink of theirs.
Instead
of
permanent
art.
Who's art?
I think art.
Who's art? You can find it. Mrs. Rudd.
I have several questions. First of all, you mentioned the desirability that the judge spend a day a month or something. Do you think it would be necessary or desirable to put that into the bill? It says that the Chief Justice is requested to assign one or more judges. And I see the possibility under the bill that's drafted of all of that, but the regulation adjudication falling behind everything else that's already in that judge's docket or whatever you call it. Do you think it might be desirable to put some Chief Justice is requested to assign a judge who will spend a day a month or something like that?
I think it might be well to put it right out there to say that the Chief Justice will designate the Superior Court judges who are specifically assigned to that task for a certain period of time. Of course, it may be that this thing will grow so that they need a special judge, but I doubt it, because it usually isn't a very good idea to do that. People get too wired into one thing.
On page 2, line 27, again, it says the courts shall schedule an informal hearing as promptly. Do you think it might be desirable to put in a timeline there, too?
Yes.
I'm familiar with the difficulties.
What do you mean within 30 days?
Within so many days after receiving the complaint.
Yes.
Okay. The other question I have is on the rules of court that we're changing. Can you tell me what they are, what they say?
I don't know what they would be, except the ones mentioned in Section 3.
That's what I mean. What are those?
I don't really know. That people upstairs did that. I would imagine it would have to do with you want to help filing fees and,
4D7 deals with service of process on estate. 7B deals with notice of appeal. 9-1 deals with filing fee in Supreme Court. And Administrative Rule 11 deals with filing fee in Superior Court. And a couple of the questions I have will relate to that Section 3.
Lisa, did
you have
another question?
Thank you, that's all.
Thank you, Art.
Mr. Chairman, one thing, in partial response to a couple of previous questions, one thing is that instead of dictating how the judge is assigned, which I guess the CJA probably ought to decide that anyhow, but you could say that these cases shall have priority during the time that the judge is assigned to sit in that court or something like that. In other words, what you want to do is get around this notion of, putting it off for 10 years. It's really about 2 years, but that's long enough.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, trying to do that legally is what concerns me, and I want to ask Mr. Cooper about that. Do you feel that we can actually put in an effective provision with regard to the priority of scheduling without interfering with the administrative power of the court? And also, do you feel that the amending of an administrative rule like Rule 11 is constitutional? You know, there's a case that says that we can amend procedural rules but not administrative rules.
Well, I think probably legislature can amend any rule of court that it wants to with a two-thirds vote, but I don't know if we would get into that kind of a situation. I think that the court will as long as we make clear what our intention is, I think, and we supply the whatever extra money is needed to do this, and they'll do it. I don't think the court system is going to do something underhanded to try to undercut our purpose here.
Mr. Chairman, let me ask Mr. Cooper about this. There's a provision in Title 34 right now with regard to the calendaring of cases involving foreclosure of mechanics and material men's liens. It's been there since 62 and before. And it says that these cases shall take priority in the calendaring of cases. And has it been your experience that provision is respected at all by the courts?
I don't know anything about mechanics and liens.
Well, in fact, in my experience, just that it has not. And you can go ahead and tell the courts all you want that the statute says these cases will have priority, and they still say, well, I'm sorry, we've got a 4-month rule on speedy trial on criminal cases. We got a bunch of criminal cases to worry about. I agree with you. I'd like to accomplish what's in the bill. My problem is doing it in a way so that what you're saying should happen really will happen, and also doing it in a way so that the court doesn't feel that it's a constitutional confrontation over the issue of whether or not we can amend their administrative rules of court.
Well, I'd say maybe the best thing to do is get ask the representative of the court system to see what they have to say about it. I've talked to Mr. Snowden about it. He is developing some kind of a position paper on it, and he's going to send it in.
A position paper on the bill, is he going to send a fiscal note also?
Yeah, I suppose to.
Mr. Lyon?
We better request that, though, Terry. I don't know if he understood the fiscal note.
We'll request that.
Okay.
I was just wondering if this parallels or preempts any of the duties of the ombudsman.
I don't think so, Jake. I think the ombudsman is mostly to shake up the bureaucracy when they're not doing their job. I don't know if the ombudsman has any standing to challenge a regulation as being unconstitutional or any of that. I imagine he could advise his client to do it.
I think the only thing he'd have jurisdiction over is the application, you know, of some regulation or rule of the administration, you know, in the format of whether they discriminatorily applied it to the guy or something like that.
Right, page 2, number 3, would that be followed in progress of that?
Or as applied petitioner might.
But you don't anticipate any problems, any overlapping?
I don't see any, Dick. I maybe conceivably could be, but I don't think that it is.
Question, I think we were talking about Brown's question or what you were discussing. So, number one, I think this is probably one of the best pieces of legislation we've had so far as addressing the problems. But at any rate, is there any way that you could put in there before you can't tell the court how to do something? Is there any penalty you can put in the sense to say to a citizen if you can't get any attention from the court for 6 months, if they don't act within a certain period of time, 60 days or 90 days, this or that happens? Is there any way to rush it along? Like they do if you go back in 4 months, you're in trouble. Maybe we can say 6 months
in
the regulation.
Yeah, you've got a good mind there, boy. He's a confusing boy like you and our client. Yes, there's a beautiful thing we could do, and it'd be absolutely constitutional. Well, and it wouldn't even involve, that is, that if the court did not address the matter within a certain amount of time, that this would be your club. The regulation would be void.
That hammers the administrative agency.
Well, it sure causes a lot of incentive.
Well, the fever more than.
Let's come back to it.
Okay.
More questions for Mr. Cooper.
Well, no, I'm not too discussing that.
Well, okay.
I'm not
well, Mr. No, Cooper is
just,
pretty good.
Well,
I'm going to ask you.
Okay, go ahead.
You got a 5 feet away around here, Steve. What we want to know is there any way in the court system that you know of, if you said that this isn't acted on in 60 days, that the person can get an injunction to stop the regulation until such time as there is a hearing, not to do away with the regulation, but some mechanism that if they don't act in 60 days, that's ground for getting an injunction to hold off the enforcement until such time as you have.
I don't see why you couldn't do that. But
you do it anyway.
I think you'd have to put in a separate procedure because the whole injunctive procedure is really long and involved.
Never mind, that's not good, but I can see, like you say, they'll keep putting this thing off and off until we haven't got time to get into regulation.
Well, they shouldn't. If the Chief Justice assigns a judge to sit 2 days a month, we'll say, or, you know, depending on the volume in that particular area, if the judge assigns Chief Justice assigns a judge to sit 2 days, and it's clear that's what he's supposed to do in that 2 days. He doesn't go off and have murder trials and stuff. I think there wouldn't be any problem. But maybe we ought to put something in there. Provide a lesson. Pride.
Well, the less violent version of what I thought of, inspired by the gentleman from Anchorage here. If some period, say even past this 30, 60 to end, give them a little zilch factor, like, you know, if no action, well, it's 120 days, I figure anyway, it gives them a little extra leeway. If there's been no determination made, say within 120 days, just have the regulation itself suspended until such time as there has been a determination by the court. And we can do that with regard to our delegation of authority to the agencies, and we're not interfering with the court's administrative rulemaking power.
Well, the trouble with that, as I said, Mr. Chairman, excuse me, the trouble with that, as I see it, is that if people are proceeding in good faith, they want an answer to these questions. And if you can say that the thing's suspended and everything for 4 or 5 years, but if a guy is trying to get a timber permit or something like that, and he's attacking a regulation that's that may be unconstitutional. He doesn't care whether the thing doesn't apply to the next 4 months. He wants to know whether it's going to apply to him at all. In other words, just the suspending of it may mean that he can run his operation for a month or a year until the judge gets around to deciding it. But he wants to know once and for all.
Well, Mr. Cooper, don't you think that if this were in there, that it would really address the behavior of the judiciary and the administration? That is, it wouldn't happen that the no assistant attorney general is going to sit on his butt if he's going to have a regulation suspended simply because a judge is not moving a case along. I'm just thinking of something that creates an incentive that is a real incentive for expeditious treatment that does not involve any arguable interference with the administrative power of the courts over the courts.
Well, the way I look at it, Mr. Brown, as chair, is that if we set this up right and the people, deal in good faith with it, and the judge is assigned to do this duty, then there shouldn't be that kind of a problem where you have to put a gun to somebody's head. But maybe, in other words, if the Chief Justice assigns a Superior Court judge to sit on April the 15th and 16th on administrative cases.
This bill doesn't say that.
That's what I say. Maybe it ought to be in there.
And I'm saying if you put it in there, you may be going across the line, and we're not amending the rules of procedure. We may be amending rules which involve the administration of the court system, and then you're into a constitutional confrontation with the Supreme Court as to whether or not we can do that, and there's at least one case that says we can't.
Well, okay. Well, look, that's pretty extreme all that. I think that I suppose everything's got some kind of potential constitutional conflict in place. If somebody wants to look at it that way, but I just think that if we do this with understanding the court system, that they'll administer it in good faith, and if they don't, you can always come back and jerk them around a little bit.
Well, at the very least,
Steve, did you envision that there would be one Superior Court judge appointed statewide or one in each district?
No, what I was thinking of was that the Chief Justice could, or whoever they decide, but would assign, say, a judge in Anchorage. Okay, maybe he'd assign Judge Ripley to sit as the administrative law judge on April 15th, 16th, 17th, and 18th, or the week of April 15th, or something like that. At that time, all of these types of cases would be heard during that week before Judge Ripley. He would make a decision within 30 days with the help of a clerk who's, or other people who are assigned to help the administrative law judge. He'd submit the opinions, and that would be it. If there's one in Fairbanks, somebody would come in and submit a petition for a hearing. The hearing petition would be sent to the Chief Justice. The Chief Justice would say, aha, I see I've got three petitions here. We'll assign Judge Taylor to sit as an administrative law clerk for 3 days, and he would hear those things within, say, 45 days.
Okay, so you do envision that assigning judges in the local areas?
Yeah.
And then, well, what about the other areas where you don't have a judge sitting?
Well, you got the same problem as you do. They just have, people have to come in where there is a judge, I guess.
Okay, but you don't envision appointing any more judges, but it's assigning. Basically, what we're doing is we're going to take the existing judges a certain amount of their time to this function.
Yeah. Larry?
Well, I was just going to suggest it may be cruel, but I had the solution. For each week of delay, of course, this is a question. For each week of delay past the set time, the Chief Justice forfeits a day of vacation.
He won't like that, man.
I play basketball with him. Those are your court judges that really hustle out there, though.
Okay, is there any more questions for Mr. Cooper?
Mr. Cooper, okay, we don't go to the extremes that the amendment I was suggesting. I would hope that, in the very least, that if we pass this or some version of it, that the suggested, if you want to call it that, the suggested procedure that you've described to the committee, okay, here's how it would work, that's really not in the bill. The bill could be read in another way if somebody could interpret the bill as just another civil action, and technically it has priority, and it'll get infinitely postponed as though it were a lien case. Suppose the current Chief Justice gets run over by a railroad train tomorrow, you know, we got to worry about whoever happens to be sitting up there. I would hope that that procedure could be outlined in a letter of intent to the committee, at the very least.
Well, I would think the best way to proceed would be to ask the court system whether they would be ready to adopt rules that would provide that, and if they're not, you know, I don't think the court system needs to fight, you know, all down the line on this thing. If they adopt Supreme Court rules of procedure, the Supreme Court adopts the rules of procedure, then we don't have anything to worry about. Otherwise, I guess we'll have to write it in the bill and pass it by a two-thirds margin.
You know, what I was talking about was the procedure you suggested, which really is not, I contend, in the bill.
It isn't.
In the very least, be described as in our committee letter of intent, for instance, showing that this is how this could work, based upon our understanding, something of that.
Oh, yeah. I do think the court system has got to be, that we have to get a commitment from the court system to adopt rules that are consistent with the purpose of the legislation here. Otherwise, you are going to have to put it in the legislation. I didn't put it in there because I thought you could just do it, you know, by talking to Chief Justice Bucci. And he's been very responsive, frankly, to things like this and new ideas. And I don't want to come in and, you know, say, you know, threaten to change all his rules on him and all that kind of stuff. Well, I think he would be amenable to, you know, initiating a change for the court.
Well, if we could find out what kind of rules would be consistent with the current view of those who administer the court system, and then we could just have a letter of intent saying that this anticipates that rules would be established and describe approximately what they would have in mind anyway, we'd avoid the confrontation. There'd still be some legislative history guidance as to what this is all about for somebody 5 or 10 years from now.
Any more questions for Mr. Cooper?
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll appreciate the head there. Mr. Peterson, would you like to testify?
For the record, I'm Art Peterson, Assistant Attorney General. We have no particular position on this bill. We do generally support what appears to be the basic purpose of making judicial remedies more accessible to the people. I would like to comment on a couple of specific points in the bill that seem to raise questions. For example, on page 2, in C3, lines 7 and 8, one ground for invalidating a regulation would be that the regulation is unreasonable per se or as applied to the petitioner. That latter part seems, in fact, the whole paragraph embodies a constitutional type of analysis that I think is not entirely appropriate here. In the constitutional analysis, one considers whether something is unconstitutional per se or as applied. In this instance, we're talking about a different concept of reasonableness, and I would imagine most individuals who even think of challenging a regulation are going to say that it's unreasonable to apply it to them. And we can foresee numerous situations involving a great deal of court time where individuals will be objecting that a reasonable regulation applicable to everybody generally and equally and for good purpose, protection of state resources, highways, whatever it may be, is invalid as to this person because it's unreasonable as to him. I think that's a little bit of an inappropriate standard and will pose some problems. One of those problems would be in conjunction with the application of subsection D. Says the court shall annul a regulation determined to be invalid under C of this section. Okay, C includes that paragraph 3 I just read. If the court finds that the regulation is not unreasonable per se, not unconstitutional, has been properly adopted, etc., but is only unreasonable as applied to this individual, then clearly I don't think it would be your intent or probably the sponsor's intent to have the court annul that regulation. So if you are going for this basic concept, I would suggest you might want to adopt some language amending that subsection D to make clear that if you are going to leave in the or as applied to language in C3, you talk about maybe a suspension or shall enjoin application of the regulation to that individual in D, rather than talk about annulment. One of the other points in section 3, on page 3, it states that portions of section 2 amend the following rules of court, and it mentions Civil Rule 4D7, which, as I mentioned earlier, deals with service of process on estate. And I don't quite see how this does. I assume that when a person brings this action under the system set up in the court, using a form established by the court, he nevertheless will have to file serve process in the same way as provided in the court rules. And I would like to ask the sponsor if that was the intent or what.
Mr. Chairman, last thing I have to say that despite Mr. Brown's kind remarks, I haven't been a real lawyer in about 4 years, but it was certainly at one time there's a case if you file suit against the state, you had to get process served on the Attorney General. How you did that was you paid a police officer and you spent a hell of a lot of money sending a piece of process down here to the police officer in Juneau, and whenever he got the time, he might or might not bring it over to the Attorney General's office. The whole goddamn process took about 3 months sometimes. There's no reason at all why the Attorney General can't get proper notice just by regular mail. Maybe, you can do that legally now, but I know at one time you had to actually have a process server cart the complaint over to the Attorney General, and trying to get that done in Juneau when you were in Fairbanks and Anchorage and Nome was next to impossible. It took sometimes literally 3 months to get a piece of paper delivered. And I know people who served it themselves who sent process servers from Anchorage at their own expense to Juneau in order to properly serve it on the Attorney General.
I believe that is possible to do by mail now. If your staff wanted to check Rule 4 and Rule 5, and maybe 6 would be relevant. So that
you're talking about Civil Rule 4, 5.
Yeah, the reference to 4D7 here is the one that deals with service of process on the state. And there are related provisions in 5 and I believe in 6 as well. But at any rate, process service by mail is okay now. There was an amendment of 4 that dealt with the mail issue, and you can serve process outside of the state, in state, etc., by mail, certified mail. So apart from whether you can do that, I see nothing in the bill that changes that. So I'm wondering what the reference to 47 in section 3 means. Then the reference to Administrative Rule 11, as Representative Brown was mentioning earlier, the Constitution in the section providing for adoption of court rules and legislative amendment, or where there is change of court rules by 2/3 vote, does distinguish between rules of practice and procedure on the one hand and rules of administration on the other hand. If you follow that through the succession of versions in the Constitutional Convention, you find that one time it was all one sentence and with one reference to legislative change. In the final version that was finally adopted by the Convention, that was separated into two sentences, and the legislative change provision applies to the rules of practice and procedure part. So I think that may pose a slight problem, and I think you could easily work your way around that with some amendment of the bill. So I don't think it's an insurmountable problem for the bill.
What's administrative rule then?
That's the one that deals with filing fees in the Superior Court.
There's a way we can do something with filing fees without amending Administrative Rule 11.
I think there might be. I do not have one presently in mind.
What if we call it something else other than a filing fee?
Well, a devious tax of my
first chairman, I don't think that's part of the bill. The filing fee. So,
I'm going to
get around that.
At any rate, that would appear to be a problem with the bill. Then I would just offer a couple of comments on some of the discussion concerning this subsection H. on page 2. First, I would suggest, apparently, what you've already agreed to is contacting the administrative director of the courts, because only somebody from the court system, I think, is really sufficiently familiar with the way in which calendaring works, the way in which any particular legislative requirement would affect the handling of court decisions. And I would urge that the committee do contact that and consider that carefully, because as I mentioned earlier, the bill's basic purpose seems laudable, and it would be unfortunate to get it hung up with some technical problem that the court has with the administration. And one of the approaches that had been tried addressing Mr. Dankworth's point was specifying, I think, a six-month period for general cases. Judges both at the Superior and the Supreme Court level had to have something resolved in 6 months, or they would not receive a salary warrant. And I believe the court generally regards that as invalid. No, his was the vacation suggestion.
Oh,
I mean, I referring to you as having raised the question of what approach, what handle could we get on getting
into
to do something. And I think that the court would probably simply hold something like that.
Actually, they do pretty much stick to the 6 months.
I think they try to, but I think they have the fit. One thing they do, they reassign cases sometimes if it's been assigned for 6 months. Like, I have one pending in the Supremes for 8 months now, and no word at all. So they reassign. There are ways of getting around
that. To push it,
Well, I'm not the appellant. I'm not representing the appellant. I think that would be his job to push it. That case, incidentally, is one involving legislative procedures where the executive branch is, in fact, defending the legislature. It's on the it's on a practice that no longer obtains in the legislature, at least according to your revised uniform
the,
rules, voice votes, adoption of free conference
reports.
What bill
is that?
Pardon?
What bill is that?
Well, I've actually got two now. The one that's in the Supreme Court is the one on the lien law. It was adopted in 74, I believe it was. And in addition to rather strange writing of the amendment, one of the houses adopted the free conference report by voice vote, and the other side is claiming both that it's unconstitutionally vague, ambiguous, unclear, etc., and that it doesn't even exist because it wasn't properly enacted.
Well, that didn't go through argument.
I won't answer. Then the other one that I just got, which is in the Superior Court, involves the medical malpractice expert panel, and it'll be using essentially the same arguments.
They're saying because we had a voice vote.
Basic argument is that the Constitution says that the yeas and nays should be recorded on final passage. The question is, what is final passage? Is it when the House adopts a free conference report and thus adopts the final form of a bill, or is it the third reading? And the Constitution deals with the term in the context of it being third reading. Okay. If that's all I had on this bill, we don't oppose it, but we would urge that you address certain detailed problems that we see raised by the bill.
Any questions from Mr. Peterson?
Just very quickly, what's the Rule 7B and 9-1 again?
7B deals with notice of appeal, and 9-1 deals with the filing fee in the Supreme Court.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to, before we have to go off next time, we're going to get a fiscal note from the court system. We'll also have the court system down here to testify. And I guess we need to check out the issue of Civil War V7 to find out whether that's necessary anymore. And also a question of Administrative Rule 11 and the filing fee. There was a bunch of other amendments.
I wanted to note that I disagree with Mr. Peterson's comments in regard to C3.
I think he did have a good point, though, that if you have 3 in there, you've got to do something different with D, that you do have to provide that if the finding was number 3, that the regulation was unreasonable as applied to that particular person, and you don't want to annul it, what you want to do is have the court, you know, enjoin the regulation to that individual and say, you know, this is not See, that's different than saying it's unreasonable as applied to the petitioner. You know, that's the application of it as opposed to being. I'm not really sure what legally unreasonable per se means.
And would you tell us, you know, if he comes down with that, you're not asking for more debt? But that we don't want to put a bunch of debt in for the
or any more jail either.
Okay, any other questions?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're done early again. We're
bye! Bye.
2 days in a row before a fourth line.
We're so good. So efficient. A lot of crappy jack committee. We'll go down in history.
Sure. House Judiciary Committee meeting, March 8th, 1978.
Okay, we'll call a meeting to order. Today is the first bill we have up to
in front of the
back related to increasing the small claims jurisdictional.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Pull up to the trial here. To the table. To the Judiciary Committee again.
Won't take much of your time. It's a very simple bill that does what the legislature did in 1970, and that is increase the amount of small claims jurisdiction.
Senate Bill 137.
For the record, my name is Pat Rohde. The bill increases the amount of jurisdiction from $1,000 to $2,000. Since 1970, when the amount was last amended from $500 to $1,000, the Bureau of Labor Statistics Index indicates that the cost of living has gone up 55%. All we're doing is keeping pace with inflation. It would not be unreasonable to increase the amount of small claims jurisdiction even further to $2,500 to account for the period of time before the legislature will attend to this matter next. If you have to entertain any questions, it's a very straightforward bill.
Okay. Questions from the committee members? Well, Pat, this means that if right now somebody has a claim for over $1,000 that they end up having to go through
Superior Court.
So this will keep a little bit of work out of the Superior Court.
Everything we can do to streamline the small claims court is for the best. The Legislative Affairs will be doing a study this summer on small claims court to propose some possible suggestions to make it easier for an average person to get into small claims court. We found that because of several Supreme Court decisions that more importantly, just through the normal growth of bureaucracy, it's become increasingly difficult for an average person to go into small claims court to present their own case. The paperwork and especially some of the procedural requirements are particularly telling on people who do go into small claims court. Hopefully, when the 11th legislature begins, we'll have a report from the Legislative Affairs as part of their interim work. This is a study that will take into account the recommendations of the Chamber of Commerce, the National Chamber of Commerce, the Bar Association, various public service groups, Alaska Legal Services, et cetera, and hopefully arrive at a product that will provide the ordinary Alaskan with much better access to the court system. And that's one of the big criticisms of justice today, is that there's very limited access. And as an attorney, I can assure you that it is precisely that. There is limited access.
Questions from other committee? What does this do to the caseload of small claims court? Do you know what relationship the area of $1,000 to $2,000 claims are?
It's difficult to tell because we're only guessing. I suspect that it will not change the statistics a great deal. We'll probably see an initial jump and then a normal increase in caseload that will parallel other areas of the court system. Generally, the small claims cases are in many ways no different from Superior Court cases. Both reflect the economic tenor of the times. And with few exceptions, I think you'll see similar patterns overall because similar social events and economic events cause the controversies, whether they're more important or at least larger dollar amounts that are Superior Court, but there's smaller dollar amounts to go into. Formerly with members of the court system, district court judges, everybody is in agreement that it's a near housekeeping bill that keeps pace with inflation and actually provides in 1978 dollars what was the same sort of jurisdiction that was formally provided in 1990 for Chambersman. There is no opposition to it, to my knowledge.
Any other members?
Move the bill.
So we motion to move out Senate Bill 137. Is there any objection to the motion? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Rody.
Thank you very much.
You owe me one, Pat.
I owe you several, probably, Brandon.
Okay, the next bill we're going to have is House Bill 582. So it's almost the fifth bill.
Fish bill,
can I leave?
Amazing the way fishermen get treated in this
city. Not even Friday.
Almost as well as.
Just about. You was.
Oh, no, my God.
Oh, sure.
I've already paid.
Yeah,
I'm
Grace Wilson, the administrator. Okay. Mr. Wilson, would you like to
Nice.
House Bill 582.
Does everybody have a copy of this bill?
Should also be a cover letter from the governor and a fiscal note.
Are we through passing?
Well, you're marking.
The recommendation will abide, the recommendation to whatever it is.
Column says do pass. You have to read where it's the funding. Okay, Mrs. Wilson, go ahead.
A little bit of background on Fisherman's Fund. It was established in 1951 to provide some medical care for those fishermen not covered by workman's compensation. The revenue is derived from the sale of the commercial fishing license, and it's 60% of the license, sale of the license. And so at the present time, $6 a year from the state and $18. From the out-of-state commercial fishermen, goes in the fisherman's fund. This covers the administration as well as the claims for the medical care. It was written territorial waters of the state in the original statute. It's continued on that. Although I think in practice, probably in the last 8 or 10 years, they were paying claims out to the 12-mile limit because they were Alaska fishermen selling their fish in Alaska, covered by the fishing license. When I questioned the Fisherman's Fund Advisory Council on what effect the 200-mile limit would have, they said go to the Attorney General's office and request, which I did, and he, at that time, designated that the territorial waters of the state meant the 3-mile limit, which means all those fishing outside the 3-mile limit were no longer covered by fishermen's fund if they had an accident out of the high sea, which probably eliminates quite a few at this time. You have to realize back in the earlier days, most of the fishing in Alaska was done on the coastal waters within the 3-mile, so it didn't discriminate against them. So amending it to read as it does, the Alaska waters mean inland and territorial waters of the state and fisheries conservation zone adjacent to the state, as established by the Section 1 of the Fisheries Conservation Management Act of 1976. All fishermen who have the crew member's license or the gear permit would now be covered by Fisherman's Fund. As present time, it's almost impossible. We're just have two on the staff. We not have the time or the means to investigate if they want to lie about where they were. And I have a feeling that sometimes we're creating that all the accidents are happening within the 3-mile limit, but we don't know. We just change their story if they know this. On the other hand, excuse me, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, I thought you were finished.
We don't know how many accidents are not being reported to us just because they are aware of the limit.
Mr. Miles.
I have the obvious idea what the Fisherman's Fund is. Is that an insurance fund that pays for medical disability?
No.
On the job, if you're out fishing, it's funny, but I cut your hand off something, they'll pay for flying in and fixing it up when the accident is.
How about for, does that also pay for, let's say you're permanently disabled, does that
no.
pay for that?
No, there's no provision. It's limited. As I said, the revenue is only $6 a year from each state license. So it's limited to $2,500
per
accident or illness.
Okay, and who pays this?
Fishermen. If this is pre-statehood, it's a dedicated fund. You buy a fishing license every year for $10, and $6 of it goes into the fisherman's fund. And then,
so what are fishermen paying for this?
And what about commercial? You have to buy a $10 personal commercial fishing license. So you buy a license for the person, and each crew member buys a license. And then you buy a license for your boat, and a license for your gear. Costs about $50. So the fisherman is entitled to emergency treatment, transportation to the nearest place where approved medical facilities are available, medical care, hospitalization. So it's kind of a self-funding thing. There's no general funds that goes in.
Right. Even administration is paid for $5.
And that's all from the fisherman. No, from license.
At this time, this year.
It's another 50.
Well, no, this year, the gear permit does, they take out the amount of money that started from that in the combined licensing.
Right.
But the crew member still has.
Okay,
$6. Ministers. Department of Labor.
Isn't there an advisory board or something?
Yeah, there's an advisory and appeals. To a council, get a fisherman from five different districts.
Do you have anything else besides this?
What's that?
Do you have anything else besides this bill? Well, we may have one possible amendment to this. Representative Eliason reminded me that we had a bill in once before to raise the limit. The total allowance is like $2,500. That's all you can get. And so if your medical costs go above that, you have to pick it up yourself. And how much was that going to raise it to?
Well, we don't have an
act. We had some legislation before that would pass the House, but it didn't pass the Senate. And I even thought it had passed the Senate, but. Because the fund actually is growing. The amount in the fund, the surplus, is growing each year, so we could afford to raise it somewhat. Because I had a case of one of the guys I know, he had a back injury, and it was more like $10,000.
Okay.
Yes, sure.
At this point, 3 years ago, I would have spoken in favor of this. At this point, I think I would speak against it. Because, the costs are growing so. And now with the fishing on the high seas, the accidents out there are very, very serious as a rule. And the protection and indemnity insurance are really looking to fishermen's fund every dime they can get because it saves them that much money. I mean, there are many, many claims that go over that. But if you raise it to 5,000, they're going to get the whole 5,000 before they're going to pay a dime into it. That was the proposed limit before.
Yeah.
And I really think you're going to find you might deplete the fund
okay,
very rapidly.
Yeah, I guess that's the question. Is we looked at it before, so that we could without the Mr. Eisen.
Well, I believe it was the administration.
Yeah, it was
the administration bill. And, what was the rationale at that particular time?
Well, at that time, the number of claims being handled were relatively small because, well, many of these facilities, medical facilities, just were not sending in claims. The amount being paid out in claims and grants was very, very small. You know, the revenue was being built up very rapidly. Since that time, there are more claims being filed. And another thing is that all these bigger vessels are covered, you know, documented vessels are covered under public health and are covered under the protection indemnity insurance most of the time. Whereas I feel that when they do have a serious accident, it can be picked up by the other insurance companies or public health.
Is that the figures on the increase?
That's the balance sheet.
It's actually the only deficit year was the first year. Since then, we've been accumulating a surplus in 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
What's happening in the
last few years? They picked up 653,000 surplus.
There was a surplus last year, too?
Surplus every year, except for the first year.
Probably not this year. I was just telling Judy Knight, our administrative officer, that.
Well, I think that already, Mr. Chairman, that. Besides other insurance policies fishermen are required to have, I think the problem is, it's, you know, not the change, one thing is that the cost of medical expenses has gone up. And this, it seems to me that the protection should go up too. Especially if you have just about $750,000 in 14 years surplus, obviously you could have paid out higher.
Yeah, they could have. I agree. But this point,
it seems to me that if it was increased, we'd know it within a year or two before he depleted the fund whether we're doing the right thing or not.
This is true. You would.
And what we're saying then is that, we recognize that there's going to be more people covered, but we also recognize that the costs are higher, so the fishermen themselves are going to pick up the difference.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of what, Nick?
In terms of,
if the fund became depleted, we'd have to raise the amount of the fishermen.
Well, no, I'm saying is at the present time, obviously the fishermen are picking up the difference now. She said that the limitations, they didn't have limitations on now, we might be in a deficit position. I don't know about that. But so who's picking up that? The fishermen.
Well, the protection and indemnity insurance are picking up some of that. You're right. There are fishermen who kind of pick it up themselves, and I'm sure it's been a hardship. Public health. I don't know whether they would come in for reimbursement more often or not. I don't know.
What was it proposed?
$5,000.
$5,000.
That's $2,500 now.
Yes.
You say that for this fiscal year, though, you don't think there's going to be a surplus?
Well, of course, I have to submit a budget, you know, like an in-state agent. And the amount that I had proposed, you know, that I thought we could live within, and the grants and claims, I'm coming to the top of it right now. 198,000 is the amount for grants and claims to come out of budget this year, and right now 170,000 has been paid out in FY 78. So obviously I'm being dangerously close.
What were your receipts this year?
Well,
they've already been paid in.
Yeah, the receipts paid in, as you see, were $246,258. So.
What, that's
76, 77. Well, that's the budget. That's the receipts I have to work on. What comes in this year, I pay. I'll work on next year.
Okay. Well, so when you say fiscal year 76, 77, that's from fishermen's licenses in 1977.
76, 77. It's from July 1 of 76.
Well, fishermen buy on a calendar year.
Right, but the revenue comes in on the fiscal year.
Oh.
It's turned into the fund in the fiscal year.
Okay, so you don't have a projection on your revenue for next year?
I did check, and it's, the revenue that has come in since July 1, 77 to December, through December, was $114,000. But now that's your low time.
Yeah, everybody buys in spring.
Right.
Okay.
So, you know.
I think it'd be a good idea to raise it, but I don't think anybody wants to, you know, run it into a deficit. I'm not sure what we ought to do.
Is there, this is we see some, we've left interest on the balance?
No, I need to do some research for my own information. But it's my understanding that because the dedicated fund, it cannot be invested, therefore, it doesn't earn any interest.
You mean there's $650,000
in a checking account someplace?
No, a checking, I mean,
And don't earn interest?
That's what they keep telling me, in revenue. I'm headed out this morning.
Now, when it says over here, this, you've got receipts and then disbursements, does that include the administrative costs?
Yes, it does.
That's the total?
Yes.
All right, good. So you can give it that to us for FY78, what you're projecting,
uh-huh.
And then...
Do you want my up-to-date amount of expenditure, too?
Yeah, I want what the actual FY77 and the projected FY78. Mr. Lass?
Are you also going to get stage up at reach the maximum and how much in excess?
Yeah, maybe you could give that to us a breakdown. Do you have a breakdown written up on the, you know, so many in this dollar category?
Yes, I can get a computer readout fairly soon on FY78. I had 75 is already prepared, I mean, I know that. But
we just have the gross breakdown, I think, you know, like 10% of them are under this figure.
Oh,
what percent of your total claims are at 25,000?
A much larger percentage than ever before are running at 25,000. I know one time when I had the feeling before, I had gone through that. That was very, very low.
I forget the reasoning you reduced the front of the boat
over
3 years ago. I thought it had something to do with inventory somehow or other. That was the reason somebody gave, I think.
Maybe, but the other thing was I'm afraid of the protection and indemnity attorneys of their usage of the fund.
Because what they're saying is that this comes first.
Yeah, sure, take what fisherman's fund will pay first, and then we'll pay what's left over, you know?
That's not reflecting our P&I rates, is it?
Oh,
I'm
sure it's not.
Same interest happening. 7% a year, just added up, and that compounds.
$400,000.
That compounds. Simple interest. Just 7% a year added year to year, that was compounded substantially. It's a ballpark figure.
Which is, Mr. Young.
Yeah. That's what you're talking about.
And then we'll get the $400,000.
Yeah, imagine 8 months that he runs. It's not long interest.
I'm sure he's saying stole it in. State surplus fund. Okay. Thank you, Mrs. Wilson. We'll run get the information for us, so we'll adjourn for today.
House Judiciary Committee meeting for March 9th, 1978, adjourned at 3:35 p.m.